Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Buenos dias, world, from the San Diego Zoo Wildlife Alliance. I'm Marco Wendt.
And I'm Rick Schwartz. And we're your hosts for Season 3 of Amazing Wildlife, a show from iHeartRadio Ruby Studio and the global conservation organization behind the San Diego Zoo and the San Diego Zoo Safari Park.
Listen as we dive into the efforts here in San Diego and spotlight the heroes working worldwide to care for the species you know and love.
Listen to Amazing Wildlife on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, everyone, and welcome. We are on episode 6 of Inclusive Collective. I am one of your hosts, Nadia Butt, and with me today is your other host, Rob Hadley. Hi, Rob. How are you today?
Nadia, I'm feeling amazing. How are you?
I'm doing good. On this week's episode, we are continuing our conversation of product development and marketing and branding and really like the nuances of putting these ideas to the test with consumers and how folks, how they come back for iteration and take these learnings test and pilot with their consumers, get some feedback, and really come back to the drawing board to really do it all over again.
And Nadia, we have a fantastic guest in order to walk us through that process. We continue on our journey through the world of startups with Hoda Mehr. Hoda Mehr is the founder and CEO of StockCard.io. StockCard.io is a platform for individual investors to discover, research, and validate their best investment ideas and for financial creators to scale their brand into large fintech companies. She used to run large global strategy and operations projects at Symantec, Aimia, and Sony Electronics before turning her passion for investing investment research into a startup. When she was a teenager, she dreamed of building her own company. The dream was an ice cream shop. We'll learn more about that. It evolved into a fintech platform as she grew up. Couple extra facts about Hoda. She is married to her best friend, loves hiking and baking, wants to be a yogi, always enjoys learning new skills, and adores dogs. Hoda Mehr, welcome to Inclusive Collective.
Thank you so much for having me. That intro actually brought very good memories. Thanks.
Why is that? Tell us.
We had a really good time early on when we started the company, deciding on like what our mission is. And, you know, I wrote a letter called Day Zero Letter, and there was no one. And my husband was making fun of me. He's like, who are you writing this letter to? I'm like, I don't know. Somebody will read it.
That's amazing. I have read the Day Zero Letter, and I encourage everyone to go out and check out the Day Zero Letter on your, I think it's on your personal site as well, right?
It should be. I see on our website, there's like an About Us section at the bottom of that.
Very cool.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for being here. It's great to meet you. Tell us a little bit about StockCard.io. Where did the idea come from? What is the problem that you were trying to solve? And at what point did you say, I'm absolutely doing this?
Yeah, so the platform as it is today, it's a place, as you said at the beginning, it's a platform for individual investors to find and discover their best investment ideas. Sort of in parallel to that is for anyone who is a financial creator. So individual investors who decide to be a creator as well, and then maybe they create a YouTube channel or a Twitter channel or thread or a Substack newsletter. It's the place for them to connect with their community and also scale their brand into big financial or fintech brands. So it's sort of a marketplace that not only allows individual investors to find and discover and validate their own investment ideas, but also for those who want to be community, who want to manage a community of retail investors to be able to scale their brand. And the idea really didn't start as this, you know. I mean, the mission from day one always was about better discovery and better investment research. Mm-hmm. And that really comes from what I was doing when I was working as a financial creator myself. So I had this Facebook group, and while I was working as a strategist in technology sector, I had a Facebook community, 30,000 members in that community. and we would talk about a stock market at the point. There wasn't much crypto investing or something like that back then. This is like 4, 5, 6 years ago. That was my side hustle or side passion, if you say. And the idea really started from there. We had so many conversations around what to invest in, what's good investment ideas and things like that. And I always felt this need that people are enabled to make one-click transaction on a platform like Robinhood, but they're not enabled to do one-click research. Mm-hmm. So we, as a society or as a technology sector, we enabled people to click that button to buy and sell as fast as possible, but we didn't enable them to do good research. And the research piece is missing. Tons of information is available. You could make fast investment decision, but the connection between decision and the information is missing. So it's sort of like a nerdy way of saying that we enable people to make decisions, but we didn't enable them to make good decisions. And that's what we wanted to. This really came through very apparent from early from all the conversations through the Facebook community. And then I really decided, I think somebody needs to solve this problem. And that was sort of my foray into startups.
That's really cool. Your background is really extensive in terms of like the corporations you've worked in and your expertise and your experience. I'm curious how all of that coupled with like your identity or your background or your upbringing played a part in your entrepreneurial journey.
Yeah, I mean, my background back when I was a teenager plays a big role in the company from two point of view. One is when I was a teenager, I would talk to my dad all the time about the world of business. So maybe a lot of father and daughter relationships are not around the world of business. Yeah. Ours was. And I remember I had so many conversations with my dad, remembering my dad preparing his suit for next week during the weekend. Back then, executives and managers would wear suits, you know, for the audience if they didn't know.
He worked in the business world.
Okay. Yeah. He was an MBA. He was a manager of running multiple companies and things like that. So we would have these like long conversations as he would prepare for the week around how he would run a company and what is a good company look like? What is a good leader? Or I would read books that my dad were interested. So there was no audiobook. I was my dad's audiobook. So I would read chapters of the book for my dad. I remember the book that is called, it's a very classic book in MBA programs. I believe it's called Lost Goal or Lost Mission. And I remember reading that and tons of like Peter Drucker book and tons of that kind of stuff. So anyways, those conversations and that background gave me this aspiration for like, I want to run my own company. Mm-hmm. And it's funny, at the beginning, I wanted to have an ice cream shop.
Oh, really?
That was like my thing.
That's like down my alley.
Yes, right? Yeah. I mean, I guess when you were like 14-year-old or 15-year-old, that's like the imagination that you have. It's like, what is so good? And what you know?
Incredible margins on ice cream, right? Are there?
Yes.
Incredible margins.
Yeah, if you get a little bit creative, I'm sure there's tons of good ways of getting great margin. But yeah, it was an ice cream shop, and then it was a bakery, and then it was a restaurant. Like in my mind, right? It was a restaurant, and then at some point it was something else. Like over the course of years, it evolved into so many things. All the way when actually I started a company, it became a fintech platform. So it's a big evolution. But yeah, I mean, but the seed was built there, and then back in those conversations, I was like, I want to have my own company and run my own company. Sure. So yeah, that's sort of like my childhood, I guess, impact on finally starting my own company. I'm surprised it took me so long though. Like I'm working in corporations for 15 years before I actually start my own company. So that's the whole story.
Yeah, I know, Rob, you probably have a question, but now I'm just so curious because you brought up, what was that like spark? So like you worked at these companies for a number of years, you said, and like, did something happen? I know you said like you had the Facebook community and there were questions that people were posing there and there was ideas being shared. But was there like an actual spark that occurred where you were like, I'm done with this corporate life. I want to go out on my own. And then thus the idea formed. Like, could you remember back to like when that spark occurred?
Yeah. I mean, the reason I didn't really start in that 15 years of corporate life is because I was busy immigrating from countries to countries.
Okay.
You know. So
where were you coming from, if you don't mind me asking?
Yeah. So I was born in Iran and I went to school in Iran. And then I worked in the Middle East for a while. And then I moved to Canada. And then I studied there and then became a citizen there. And then I moved to the U.S. and then became a citizen here. So when you basically go through that experience, it's very difficult to also feel the stability that you can now start a company, right? Mm-hmm. So I've seen a lot of me not starting was just like busy getting used to the new countries and new culture and, you know, whatever that it takes for you to start new in new environment. And then the second thing is my husband and I, at the time, my boyfriend, did try to start a company right after I finished my MBA, he finished his master's, and then we couldn't raise enough money for that. So that was also like, we did try one time to start something, or I tried to start a company and that didn't work. And then we realized, okay, we better go and establish our network and establish our, you know, financial stability, then start. So over the course of years, we always had this notebook that we would write our business ideas on it. So we had all these ideas. When I was in the United States and I was working at Symantec at the time, but that was really when I got very, really, really adamant about, okay, I have to do this. And there was a few things. One was sort of the framework of regret minimization. I asked myself, okay, I've been waiting for this and I haven't yet started for a long time. So if I'm like 90 years old, would I come back to my 30-year-old and say, why didn't you start a company?
Yeah,
why are you scrolling from life?
The regret could be so real, right?
Like, it could be very real, right? Yeah. That was one. And then the other one is just like what was happening in the Facebook community and what was happening in the world of investing. As I was always an investor and it was really bothersome to me to see a lot of people don't make good investment decision. And it was very easy for me to see why it, and we talked about it, right? People can transact very fast. There's tons of information is available, but there's no enablement in terms of good discovery and validation of investment ideas the way I thought it should exist in the world.
Buenos dias, world, from the San Diego Zoo Wildlife Alliance. I'm Marco Wendt.
And I'm Rick Schwartz. And we're your hosts for Season 3 of Amazing Wildlife, a show from iHeartRadio Ruby Studio and the global conservation organization behind the San Diego Zoo and the San Diego Zoo Safari Park.
Listen as we dive into the efforts here in San Diego and spotlight the heroes working worldwide to care for the species you know and love.
Listen to Amazing Wildlife on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And so, you know, we talk about that. We go back to the early days of building that product. Right. So, I mean, I think about you're creating a product that's simplifying something, right? I mean, investment information is too simple, right? It's, there's balloons and things, you know, in the background, or it's like overly complex and dry, right? So it takes a ton of work to actually get that, what you've built, right? And you really have to iterate and go through that product, right? And as you're building it. So I just wondered, you know, what would that process look like for you? You said that what you see on the site today is not what you started with. The idea is not what you started with. Talk us through that evolution of the idea and what you have today.
Yeah, absolutely. I have to say we're still iterating, right? I don't think you could grow fast as a startup or be a successful company, even if you were a big company, without iterating. Mm-hmm. So when you stop iterating and say, I found the golden product, you're going to lose your edge very soon. So I don't think good product development, especially in technology sector, and especially the ones that are like consumer facing, can ever stop. So I think that's just the foundation of a good product. You have to always iterate. But where we started, it was very interesting. So I'm not a technical person, right? So when I started, it was only me. And I couldn't just like go start coding and like build something up, right? I did try to learn code, by the way.
Oh,
actually,
cool.
I had asked my brother to teach me. And like we would do a session every week. And then at some point, I'm like, okay, I think my time is better spent doing something else. This is going to take 5 years for me to learn.
Yeah, the ROI is not very high on that, right?
Yeah, exactly. So what I did was I started thinking about what I can do. And then I said, well, I know how Google Sheets work and how Excel works. So And my product is an information product per se. So I started from Google Sheet. And the very first version of the product was a Google Sheet. And then I went and used Weebly. And it's, at the time, Weebly was not bought by Square. It was then a standalone company. And it's a drag, like it's sort of like Wix.com or something like that, like a drag and drop website building. So I created a website. And then I linked it to my one Google Sheet, which was an evaluation of the simplification of investment research for Amazon stock. And then that's
single stock.
That was it. Yeah. And then I started like just sharing that. I'm like, what do you guys think about it? Is this simplifying your investment research? There's nothing else. And we started getting a lot of feedback and conversations from. Actually, we started not getting a lot of feedback. We got some feedback from the Facebook community. This is all in that Facebook community.
Who's in that Facebook community? Like primarily who? Like people who, is it?
Retail investors, individual investors. It's basically individual investors who are just looking to research and get ideas. Or do they just like enjoy having fun and talking, investing, right? As a side hobby, I guess. So yeah, a Google Sheet on Weebly. Then it turned to a PDF. So we started like getting a little bit more visualized. And then I said, well, I can make a PowerPoint slide and then save it in a PDF. And then in PDF, you could do like a scroll motion. Mm-hmm. So you could like do hyperlink and then it faster scrolls to something, which sounds like click, feels like a click movement.
Totally.
So I created a PDF. And then maybe there was like 10 PDFs on the Weebly website. So it was like an icon and then people could download the PDF. And then from there, it all started. Then I found a developer and then we started coding and it was all looks and no backend. So I clearly remember we would hard code data, copy and paste from Google Sheet into the actual code, hard code data. And I did learn some coding. I mean, some coding meaning. Copy pasting things and pushing things live. It's not coding, right?
It's like, more than I can do.
How could you change a thing into a code and into like a front end code? No back end, obviously. And they like push it live so that people can actually see it. So that was like for many months, we were just copy pasting, hard coding things. And then we realized, okay, this is interesting. People are interested in, and all along we're capturing feedback, right? Obviously we're not doing this in like isolation. We're all along, we're capturing feedback, the elements of the PDF document first, and then the elements of what went online kept changing, right? We kept adding things, tweaking, changing the way we're adding things. So we started adding a request button. This is now 2017. We got hunted on Product Hunt. In one day, we got like 3,000 requests for these hard-coded, non-scalable things. And then we were like overruled. Like, there's no way I can publish, copy and paste 3,000 things into a hard. And we're like, okay, we're going to send an email to all these people. And we're saying, well, yes, you did request, but we're going to prioritize the most requested one and publish the first 50. And then we will let you guys know when we have the rest. There was no way we could do it, right? Like we started doing it and then like it would take about 2 hours to refresh something, like copy paste things properly and make sure everything looks good. So 3,000 requests times 2 hours, like I would be still doing
it. Yeah, you're working on it. Yeah.
Yeah. So we're trying to publish things. So then we were like, okay, we need to make this scalable. So we added an API connection.
What's an API connection?
API connection is that instead of copy and pasting, you buy your data, your raw data from a data provider, and then you create some sort of a schedule that would automatically go and pull that data. And then you would build the all the required steps required for your product to get all that data and then like visualize it the way you want it.
Okay.
So that's what we build. And then at this point, we obviously need developers, right? It's totally out of my scale. At that point, it's like, yeah, I did try to figure out what API is and how you would get it, but then and what's an endpoint and how you would pull the data. But there's no way I could build it by myself, right? Basically, we added a developer. I guess that's sort of the very early on iteration process.
There's so much learning there, right? Like everyone should hear that story that's trying to build a product, right? In terms of if you had waited until it was perfect before you were launching your product, you'd still be figuring it out on the, right now, right? It wouldn't be built to this day, but you started, you know, super simple and iterated until a point where you actually needed to hire a developer, right? And so were you still bootstrapping when you hired the developer?
Yeah. So that's actually another reason we went through these very iterative process is because we were bootstrapped and we're still primarily bootstrapped, although we do now have investors.
For folks, mm-hmm. our listeners who don't know what bootstrap is, what's that lingo mean?
It means that you would rely on your own funds or your own revenue. Okay. So you don't bring external investors to grow the company, to build the company.
Okay. Thank you.
And I think it's just sort of, it's a blessing in disguise. It's very difficult to bootstrap a company or product off the ground because then you have to pay. First of all, you don't have to take any salary because it's from your one pocket to another pocket. So you can't really pay yourself. Okay. That makes no sense. But then you have to pay your team for sure. Mm-hmm. And then that means you have to be very careful about who do you pay because you don't have the luxury of, let's try this or let's try that. You're like, what is the one thing that moved the needle for this product? Yeah. And I am only going to pay for that because there's no way I'm going to pay for anything else, right? This is from this pocket. That is not that's not unlimited. So I think the fact that we were bootstrapped at the time and had no revenue actually helped into our product development and iterative process because we really, really focused on what's going to move the needle. We did have this thing on my screen. I had this little note, the sticky notes that says what's moving the needle. And that was always, I'm like, this thing we're doing, is it going to move the needle also? Is this like 100% priority and are we going to fund it or not?
I had another question about in terms of like the product, right? So you talked about the product is for people that are new to investments, right? And so I don't know if you said it explicitly, but what role do you focus on women? How explicit are you about going out and talking to women in terms of like how they use the product and how effective it is for them?
Yeah, it's actually interesting. So it's a female founded, obviously, product, and I'm a woman investor, and I would have loved our product to be really attractive and helpful to women. But unfortunately, only 15% of our users or 20% of our users are women. I'm basically female and the rest are men. The majority of our community are men. The majority of our audience are men. I think it's just, I spend so many hours on solving this problem of why women are not investing.
Yeah, I'm like so fascinated, like why you think from your observations being in this world, why do you think it's like a male dominated interest or like active? I don't know if it's like an active, I don't know what it is. So that, interest, yeah.
I think, we spent so much time. I mean, I went to so many women conferences in San Francisco as a speaker trying to inspire women to invest. I even would offer one-on-one half a day coaching for free for women to kind of like get started in investing because I thought maybe there's some barriers there. Mm. Maybe someone in 2019, I had this personal aspiration to inspire 52 women to invest. So one per week, basically, to invest. I've done to be honest, I've spent so much time on trying to inspire other women to do it. And then in the process, I've been trying to collect the information around why women are not investing as much. Mm-hmm. And I don't really have a good answer. A lot of it is cultural. Mm. A lot of it is just coming from traditionally women are more managing budget and managing household, take care of like things that are safe and make sure the household is safe as opposed to taking some risk to grow the wealth of the company. Although it's not like applicable to it. Like there's a lot of women I know in my community that are investors and fund managers. And so that's basically that. But we know on a statistics, but we see it from our own data, there's less female people who actually invest. So it is cultural. I've talked to people who would say it's not good to talk about. Like they were brought up as like a topic of money. It's not a polite topic, or you wouldn't ask about topic of money, or you wouldn't think about it. It's not the right thing. Or you shouldn't care about creating wealth because it's not a good person does that. Like money is like evil, I mean, quote unquote. I don't know, that kind of book. So there is a lot of, there's like cultural, there is basically religious related, there's like family related. There's all sort of things that results into it. And maybe women are a little bit more say want to be a little more safe, but they're more nurturers as opposed to risk takers. And investing is very much associated with lots of risk. So it could be that.
Yeah. You know, it's so fascinating, Hoda, because for me, and I don't want to speak for all of my friends or all the women out there, but for me, I think it's because it's intimidating. It's just the world of investing and then also like taking that risk for long-term growth, right? Like taking this huge amount of money and putting it into a place where like maybe you need it short-term and not able to kind of let go of it long term. But I guess my question for you is, how would someone like me or my group of friends, how would we engage with your product? How would we use it? Is it designed for kind of advanced and beginner folks? Like what would you say to that?
Yeah, I mean, the whole foundation of the product is to make it accessible to anyone with any background, without any finance knowledge, to be able to make an investment decision that is based on facts and data and it's not mistaken. That's why we built the product, right? Obviously, an advanced user can come to a platform and say, oh, good, I usually look at this and this and this, and then this platform already took care of this and this and this, so I trust this visualization that is here, or I trust this screener that is here. But for a novice person, we've made it so like when you land on a stock card, there's like literally no jargon. Everything is basically in the day-to-day language. And we made a lot of those sort of decisions to make sure it is accessible to anyone with any background. That's why I'm very surprised that why we still don't have like a good distribution of women and men. And I think that's because just we acquire our users from the communities. We are a first community, first or community-driven product. And then where the communities are men in those. Like the men are the ones who are in these communities. So when you acquire users from there, you obviously get a disproportionate women and men, I guess, user acquisition. But yeah, I believe, and that's our goal from day one, has always been in anyone with any finance back, any level of background, with any level of knowledge should be able to make that investment decision. And we're basically done the work so that it's accessible.
Very cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I did want to ask, so, you know, when you interview someone, you go back and look at some of the things that they've done. And fortunately you kept a very clear record of the things that were happening to you as your company was growing. Right. So thank you for that. It made this very easy to prepare for. A lot of those early posts that you made about growing the company, about starting the company, they're very defiant. They're like, okay, I know, you know, people aren't necessarily getting it, but I know this is a good idea, and you know, we're gonna plow forward. And then contrasted to, you know, the answer that you gave earlier about iterating, pivoting, how did that evolve for you? What's the difference between just having that very narrow-minded vision of like, I'm going to do this, and I know that I have the founder's insight that I know this is a problem and I need to get this done because it's important, and okay, sometimes I need to make a change. How do you think about that?
Yeah, I think my conviction that this is a product that's needed, and I still believe the same that it's a product that is needed, and I still think we need to solve the problem. The problem still does not even we exist, but it's not fully solved, basically, and we still need to work on it. Is I have conviction in the problem, right? But I don't have conviction in the one solution that I think it should be, right? So I think the conviction in problem just gave me from day one and still does the push or the drive to keep pushing forward, even if some other people don't believe in it. But I don't have any conviction about the solution. So I have some ideas about the solution, right? But the solution has to come from the users. The solution has to come from the user. Not that the user's ever going to tell you what to build, but it's their response and reaction to the product that you put forward in front of them, right? So go back to it. I absolutely 100% have conviction in the problem. I have no strong opinions about the product. And it is an iterative process because basically it's like this. You come up with you have a problem, and then you come up with a solution, say, okay, we're going to solve it in this way. And then you build what's known as minimum viable product, something which was for us was whatever, you know, we talked about it. You put that minimum viable product in front of the users, and the users start interacting with it. at the beginning, a lot of it is just, oh, it's not designed well, or it's so friction, it's so many frictions. So still, they're not really questioning your solution. They're trying to just interact with your solution. So what, you start figuring out those frictions and then you solve it. And then the product becomes a nice product. And then you start looking at whether they're actually using it, how much time they're spending. Are they actually solving their problem? Are they willing to pay for it? So for us, we started paid version of our product very, very early on. Some of it because we needed revenue, and some of it was, I always thought payment from a stranger is the most important signal of product market fit, mm-hmm. which tells you the user is willing to depart with, say goodbye to their cash because they see you are creating value. This regardless of how crappy your actual product is, you know, because your crowded product is not the perfect product that you wanted to put out, right? It is being iterated. So yeah, you start looking at the data and see whether users are spending time on it, spending their money on it, and then are they coming back? What is your retention rate and stuff like that? And then you start realizing, okay, something's working, and then you iterate and you iterate and you iterate.
That's awesome. Yeah, excellent. Yeah, so we like to ask everyone, what diversity, equity, and inclusion advice would you give to an entrepreneur entering in the startup space?
I think from a hiring point of view or from your team point of view, it's very important to give chance to underdogs and people, or the chance to people who do not look like the perception of what you thought this person should look like. Mm. Because we all grow into this thing that the developer, it's the guy in hoodie or girl in hoodie, mostly guys, obviously, because that's the perception of the society. It's a guy in hoodie that who lives in San Francisco or like, you know, and comes from tech background. But that's not just definitely a good, that could be a good developer, but any other profile could also fit into that. And then like a good startup team means this, and you have to have this, like this kind of office, and you have to look like this, and you have to have this culture. And then none of those stereotypes or none of those commonly accepted definitions are, they could work, but they're not exclusive to success and exclusive to that's the only way of doing things. And for us, we were, some of it were by design and some of it by, because I always think I am an underdog, and everybody they always look at me and they're like, who is this girl wants to change things in Wall Street, right?
Like, they underestimate you. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm always underestimated. Yeah. So because of that, I always try to give chance to everybody. Mm-hmm. And I try to just say, there's a mental model in your mind. There's a mental vision of what is this person should look like. And then there's the actual person in front of you. And then you should just disconnect these two and see whether this person, give a chance to this person. And it worked for us very well, because as a matter of fact, people who fit into that stereotype definition of a role ended up leaving the company, and people who did not fit into that stereotype stayed and created so much value for the company.
Yeah, that's incredible. Yeah, that's incredible. Hadamer, this was an incredible conversation. We thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, bros. It was a really good conversation, and I'm very excited to listen to the entire season of your podcast.
Awesome. Very cool.
Hi, folks. We are back and at the point of our Conversations, where Rob and I will reflect on the conversations that we just had with our guest, Hadamer Meyer. Rob, I feel like I just learned so much from Huda. Like, her conviction to solve this problem of one-click research is so apparent. And, you know, it's such a massive problem to solve for. And what I really love is that she's leveraging this community that she built for testing her prototype and really getting feedback. And much of her conversation reminded me of if you remember our days doing lean methodology and really creating just-in-time like services and products and piloting them and testing them with our business partners. So what did you take away? What did you think of the conversation with Huda?
Yeah, I mean, I was so fired up and I really wanted to start a company after talking to Huda. It's like she's very inspiring, and the passion and the stick-to-itiveness that she demonstrated in building this company is really impressive. I do encourage listeners to go back and if you, you know, want to check out Hoda and her page, I think it's on the stockcard.io site. You can get to her page where she blogs about the early days of starting her company. And it's just really impressive and it's really fun to walk through the journey with her. So I would recommend our listeners do that as well. So the things that, you know, I really took away and things that I think that our listeners should be focused on, you know, first is listen to what the customers are telling you. As we went through there, right, and we had the conversation, I think some listeners will look at my questions and say, you were trying to get her to make the connection between being a woman and then the customers that she was serving or the product that she was building. And I really didn't want her to say anything in particular, but I was really interested in the process. She said she tried, I don't know if you caught, she said she tried everything to get women interested in her product. Yeah. And she had to admit that at a certain point after trying everything, that her product didn't necessarily appeal to women for whatever reason. And I think it's really admirable of her, right? I think it demonstrates that she was willing to listen, that she was humble enough to take that feedback, and that she was laser focused on finding product market fit. She didn't let her own biases and her own convictions and interest enter into the equation as she sought feedback and listened to customers. So I think it's really important to be very objective, look at the data and admit when perhaps the thing that, or your hypothesis can't be proven out.
That's great, Rob. Yeah. So what else did you take away or what other ideas did you get from Hoda?
Yeah. One other thing that I loved was she even was iterating on the team. So I also loved her advice of that image that you have in your head of the person that will be part of your team and will help you along your journey may not be exactly what ends up working out for you. So I don't want to give the impression that she was cycling through team members. Like she wasn't just turning and burning team members.
I was going to say, Rob, don't get any ideas here. You're not getting rid of me.
Yeah, she was iterating on the product idea in that sense. But she did say that at the beginning, she had a person that really fit the profile of what she thought would be the right person for her on a technical side, and it didn't work out perfectly. She then, over time, brought in someone who didn't fit her profile of what she was looking for, and that person ended up being the perfect team member for her and the perfect collaborator. So I love that advice. I love the way that she framed it, and I think it's really useful advice for anyone building a product in the early stages of their company.
Absolutely. All of it is such great insight and learnings. And thank you for sharing some also some tips and some suggestions for our listeners. So that is it for this week's episode. The Inclusive Collective podcast is a production of Refillion Media. If you would like to hear more, we encourage you to listen to some of the prior episodes. We'd also love to hear from you. So if you would like to shoot us an email at info@refillion.com, we'd love to hear from you. And you can also find us on Instagram. Our handle is @Inclusive Collective Podcast. And don't forget to like, rate, and subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts today. Thanks, folks.
Thanks, everyone.
We will see you next week.
Buenos dias, world, from the San Diego Zoo Wildlife Alliance. I'm Marco Wendt.
And I'm Rick Schwartz. And we're your hosts for Season 3 of Amazing Wildlife, a show from iHeartRadio Ruby Studio and the global conservation organization behind the San Diego Zoo and the San Diego Zoo Safari Park.
Listen as we dive into the efforts here in San Diego and spotlight the heroes working worldwide to care for the species you know and love.
Listen to Amazing Wildlife on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Buenos dias, world, from the San Diego Zoo Wildlife Alliance. I'm Marco Wendt.
And I'm Rick Schwartz. And we're your hosts for Season 3 of Amazing Wildlife, a show from iHeartRadio Ruby Studio and the global conservation organization behind the San Diego Zoo and the San Diego Zoo Safari Park.
Listen as we dive into the efforts here in San Diego and spotlight the heroes working worldwide to care for the species you know and love.
Listen to Amazing Wildlife on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Buenos dias, world, from the San Diego Zoo Wildlife Alliance. I'm Marco Wendt.
And I'm Rick Schwartz. And we're your hosts for Season 3 of Amazing Wildlife, a show from iHeartRadio Ruby Studio and the global conservation organization behind the San Diego Zoo and the San Diego Zoo Safari Park.
Listen as we dive into the efforts here in San Diego and spotlight the heroes working worldwide to care for the species you know and love.
Listen to Amazing Wildlife on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.